You're listening to Last Word Soccer Club Radio. Only here, lastwordonsports.com.
What's up, Internet? My name is Matt Pollard, and you are listening to Last Word Soccer Club Radio, only here, lastwordonsoccer.com, powered by Last Word on Sports Incorporated, the Beat of Game Network, and Roughneck Scars. My good friend Daniel Sperry, we are living in a world where the Colorado Rapids and the San Jose Earthquakes both won their most recent game, and they play this weekend. Are we living in MLS Twilight Zone? And if so, how do we get out of here?
Yeah, I don't know what the heck happened, but, like, considering, like, it's so weird. For you have FC Dallas, who come off their big win in Kansas City, their first time winning in Kansas City in 7 years, and then they go and they host San Jose in what should be a walkover for them, and then Jesse Gonzalez absolutely loses all bearing of like direction and where he was and like where he was at. Gives up a couple goals, and then you have Colorado doing like most of the Western Conference a giant favor in getting the comeback win against the Galaxy at home. Zlatan less Galaxy, but impressive for two terrible teams going in against two teams in really good form at the moment, pulling out wins. I know you felt good. I felt good after that. Sporting KC also ground out the win in Houston, in which was a hell of a match. If any of you guys were paying attention to that one. So big stuff for this weekend for Colorado and San Jose. And, of course, they get to play each other this weekend for the ultimate – well, not the ultimate. It's like the half – this is like – what is this?
This is a wooden spoon six-pointer this weekend, Dan.
This is a Dan-Matt Derby showdown that is probably the equivalent of what's the tournament – that is only for teams not in the Premier League.
Tournament.
The knockout tournament. There used to be a tournament.
Oh, like the John Paint Trophy or something?
Yeah, like that's exactly what this is, the equivalent of this Dan-Matt Derby showdown. This is what winner gets the Johnston Paint or Johnstown like Paint Trophy. Like that's the level that's this. I was trying to say the Community Shield, but the Community Shield is at least like top level teams.
Yeah, for the most part. This would be like, you know, this is like a League Two, like Grimsby Town versus Barnet, like competing for who's going to get relegated out of the Football League. But in any case, yep. Dan, let's get it.
Plymouth Argyle and Carlisle United.
Oh my God. Okay. In any case, we will be talking Premier League a little bit later once we get to Pick'ems briefly, folks. But we've got a great show for you tonight. As Dan and I were talking, very busy week for American soccer. The transfer window has officially closed, and by now, pretty much any moves that happen in the wee hours last night have officially been announced. So Dan and I are going to talk about transfer window. But first, Dan, let's get to the Lamar Hunt U.S. Open Cup. Yesterday, the Philadelphia Union defeated the Chicago Fire pretty convincingly, in my opinion, by a score of 3-0. Union pretty much playing all their starters, and they clearly look like a more organized team. Not really sure what the Chicago Fire were doing. They had Bastian Schweinsteiger and Gitai kind of looked okay, but not a whole lot of chance creation from them. Corey Burke did Corey Burke things, and CJ Sapong actually gets a goal, so they win that one 3-0. And then in an absolute barn burner down in Houston, Texas, Houston Dynamo tying LAFC 3-3 through 120 minutes, and then Houston Dynamo winning 7-6 on PKs. You had Diego Rossi with a hat trick. He scores in the sixth minute. Dynamo proceed to dominate the rest of the first half. Andrew Wenger and Mauro Minotas gets on the board. Memo Rodriguez with a really nice goal in the 70th minute appeared to put the game to bed there. At that point, Houston were up 3-1, Dan, but then Diego Rossi, with a goal in the 78th minute, and then basically at the death, 90 minutes plus 5 to ultimately tie at 3-3. We play scoreless through the 30 minutes of extra time with both teams getting some really good chances, particularly Houston. You get Oscar Boniac-Garcia missing an opportunity, and then in the last shot of what would have been the fifth round, Lorenz Simon going for something, and he gets saved with a really, really limp shot that Joe Willis is able to save, and then ultimately it was Latif Blessing getting denied in the seventh round after Felipe Senderos puts it in to get Houston it. Dan, your general thoughts on these two games, and now you've got Houston Dynamo hosting Philadelphia Union. If we exclude, you know, the Dynamos, two MLS Cups, you're going an entire decade where neither of these teams have won some trophy. Obviously, the Union have never won any significant hardware, and this will be their third U.S. Open Cup final in recent memory. One of these two teams is walking out with the trophy. Your thoughts on the semifinals and the two finalists?
So the semifinals went the exact opposite of how I thought they would go, because I thought LAFC would be able to take it, especially considering the way Houston showed over the weekend against Sporting Kansas City. I mean, they showed they had no mental, they were shot mentally. They were all over the place emotionally in that game against Sporting Kansas City, and just continued to compound themselves. And so you have LAFC, who I believe they lost. Did they lose or did they draw last
week? Yes, Danny Royer.
Danny Royer. Okay, so they lost. So you have them losing in New York, going in there. I figured that they'd be like their second choice team would be enough to really try and grind out a result. And really, I mean, they scored three goals. They gave up three goals. The Western Conference one ended. I was shocked that Houston was in it more than they were. I was shocked at how well or how far into it Houston was, and that was impressive, I guess. Houston, they're kind of built for knockout games. I really feel like they're really built for these like one off knockout games, but they do have some serious issues that keep rearing their head. So we'll see how well those, and particularly in closing out games, they've dropped, you know, multi-goal leads multiple times this year. One notably in Houston in Kansas City, where they were up 2-0 at halftime, and then gave up three goals in the final 25 minutes of that match to Sporting Kansas City, including two in the final five for Sporting Kansas City to flip that 0-2 loss to a 3-2 win. They've now given up. They're down 3-1 and squander away that lead. There's a lot of inconsistency with them, so we'll see how it all plays out into their final in U.S. Open Cup. Same with Philadelphia. I felt for a while that they could have been like the Cup team, but since Chicago's also been really impressive, so I felt like they could also be the Cup team. And so now you have Philadelphia going into Chicago and absolutely destroying them. That was impressive, like really, really impressive for me from a pretty young Philadelphia squad all around, and a squad that's probably, I think they're in the playoff race this year, but I think they're more serious about their future contending opportunities and not this year, where Chicago is really pushing. It's kind of playoffs or bust for them. So I was impressed with Philadelphia going in and getting the result that they did. We'll talk more about the transfer fallout in Chicago that happened after that, which is really interesting. But you know, this is a Philadelphia team that if a lot of their young key pieces in there start playing and really can start clicking, and Cedric Sapong starts clicking with those goals, I think this is a team with the Union that can really make a push in MLS. You look ahead to the final, I actually like Philadelphia. I know it's in Houston. Home team tends to do well in this tournament unless you're Philadelphia. Ask Philadelphia about that when they hosted and lost to Sporting Kansas City in penalty kick shootouts back in 2015. So, you know, they'll go on the road and look to be, you know, the first road team to win since they lost home, which will be interesting. I'll be up for this game. I don't know if Houston will, just because the Houston fan base has not showed up in both the league play and the U.S. Open Cup. I mean, last night the entire upper deck was not full, and Carlos Vela played in the game. So, like, I mean, the showing in Houston was lame on that part. I'm interested to see how it's going to look in Houston for the final. Hopefully they show up. I'm also hoping, like, all of Philadelphia just kind of flies out there and packs the whole thing out and makes it a virtual home game for them, because that could potentially happen with the way the support that Houston's been getting. But I thought it was good. Play from Philadelphia. I thought Houston survived. Maybe got lucky in the penalty kick shootout. It is kind of a crapshoot in the PKs. I wouldn't agree that while they were up 3-1, any team that squanders a 3-1 lead, I would never say deserves to have won said match. So I still have big questions about Houston. But you got a Houston Philadelphia final. Not as appealing and sexy as maybe some of the bigger names in MLS, but I think it's going to be really interesting, especially with the the recent history between Philadelphia and Houston that took place a couple weeks ago. So interesting final coming up, but you know, Philadelphia deserved winner. Not so sure on Houston, but you know, they get through on penalties and they end up hosting the thing.
I agree, Dan. You know, the Philadelphia result against Chicago, I completely did not see coming. I'm going to echo the words of Bobby Warsaw earlier this week, saying that this is kind of proof of trusting the process, though at very least that they were heading under the right direction, that now with the new technical director, even with Ernie Stewart gone, that the core that they have is something they can build on for the rest of this year, maybe make it to the playoffs, maybe make some noise there, or at the very least, they're in a good upward trajectory going into 2019. The Fire ultimately did not show up. I kind of thought that, you know, given that they didn't do anything in the window, that this was kind of be open cup or bust at this point, with the moves that they did, that they made earlier today that we'll be talking in a couple minutes, Dan. I don't know where they were going from it. And I think this is kind of pretty much the nail in the coffin that is their season, if you ask me. Houston and LAFC was absolutely lit. And I think, you know, from a fan of either of those teams, you were having a heart attack, but this was the perfect, like, I'm a neutral. I'm just watching this game, I have no stake. You know, this is the equivalent of like watching an NBA game where you don't care who wins and you just want to see absolute chaos and dunks. So that's how I felt about this one. I was kind of expecting Houston to close it out and dominate, just given the way that they played over the weekend. And then you saw Bob Bradley starting, you know, mostly a preferred starting 11 at Red Bull Arena. So you're figuring, you know, flying from LAX all the way across this country to play New York Red Bulls. You lose that one in a pretty tough one that, you know, takes a bite out of your fitness. Then you have to fly all the way to Houston and then play in humidity, where Houston didn't have to deal with all that travel. They rotated the squad and the coaching staff made a couple of substitutions in their game over the weekend. So I kind of thought Houston was going to be fresher. And, you know, I would have thought that 3-1, at least based on the performance that you saw from both teams, was pretty fitting given it was the 75th minute. Diego Rossi, you know, absolutely balled out though, but I thought the team that overall was better and the team that has taken this tournament more seriously deserved to advance. So I think, you know, these are two teams that certainly have cared and prioritized this tournament. And I think either way, one of them is going, you know, unless you just have an absolute snooze fest of a final and one team wins on a lucky bounce, I think you're absolutely going to have a deserving champion, whoever it ends up being. I'm kind of leaning towards Philly because just, you know, at some point a blind squirrel finds a nut in one of these finals, and maybe being the road team in this final is going to take a little bit of the pressure off of them. And I'll echo your point, Dan, of, you know, you're not even filling the lower bowl section, which I'm going to guess is not even a third of the reported 22,000 seat capacity at BVA Compass Stadium. Like, if it's anything remotely close to that for the final, that's just going to be an absolute embarrassment for the league and the tournament and for Houston as a soccer market. I hope there is a strong traveling contingency from the Sons of Ben. I hope that is, at the very least, if not sold out, you know, close to a regular season for, you know, a Houston game. Granted, that'll be midweek, but, you know, I'm hoping for a good final. I'm hoping for a good atmosphere and a nice story to write about a team, you know, bringing home some hardware that hasn't been able to do so. And either way, it's going to be Philly trusting the process, or it's going to be Houston doing this, you know, with a bare minimum budget and Wilmer Cabrera being an absolute genius with his personnel decisions and getting production out of them. Moving on, Dan, let's get to MLS transfer window, folks. We're going to jump straight into the roundtable tonight, folks, and just do a huge rapid fire. Excuse you, Dan, with all of the MLS transfer window stuff that we'll have. We'll start in Kansas City, Dan. Peter Vermes was burning the midnight oil this past week. Who have they added, and what do you think of them?
So, Sporting Kansas City on Monday announced that they acquired Christian Namath from the New England Revolution. This trade apparently was a long time coming, according to Peter Vermes, that they had, this was originally part of the Dom Dwyer deal that was done last June, where the original deal was that there was something that was going to go towards Columbus that would net Sporting Kansas City the top allocation spot, which Columbus then held at the time. And Orlando would get Dom Dwyer, and Sporting Kansas City would have their guy, and then Columbus would get some type of allocation money, and then they would eventually use that allocation spot. Sporting Kansas City would eventually use that allocation spot to land Christian Namath in his return. Columbus balked at the price, raised it, and New England outbid Sporting Kansas City for that top allocation spot, and then went and acquired Christian Namath. who they didn't need at the time, and it was a weird move that didn't make any sense. It just seemed like they were just trying to block and annoy the crap out of Sporting for whatever reason, because they really had no reason to add him with Kai Kamara, Teal Bunbury, Juan Agudelo, and another five other strikers that they had on their roster at that time. So now Sporting Kansas City goes in and gets him for $350,000 in allocation money and a 2020 first-round draft pick, which if you're Sporting Kansas City, the way you run your club, you're probably betting on that one being in the later rounds, given that you see yourself as a perennial contender in the league and not towards the bottom, where you're picking in the first five. And even then, the MLS draft in recent years, if you're not picking in the first five, you're likely not getting a guy who can even contribute minutes in their first season with the team. So you move on from that. Sporting Kansas City add Christian Namath. They are planning on him being their number nine, which most people, if you remember Christian Namath with Sporting Kansas City, and he played exclusively, I wouldn't say exclusively as a winger, but he did play a majority of his 2015 season with them as a winger, scored 16 goals, 7 assists in 33 games throughout all competitions, the second leading scorer in Sporting Kansas City history in the U.S. Open Cup, 5 goals, and he did it all in one season, which matches Daniel Shalloway's record from last year, actually. Daniel Shalloway, I think, now holds the record for most goals in the U.S. Open Cup play for Sporting Kansas City. But anyways, Namath will jump in and play as a number nine. It's apparently his actual real position, and that is where Sporting Kansas City, when they originally brought him to the club, brought him in to back up Dom Dwyer. But he was so good in training camp that they decided that Vermees felt like they could put him out wide and have him cut inside and be a second inside forward alongside Dwyer. Dwyer's most prolific year came in 2015, was still pretty darn prolific. It worked well for them then. Now this is the perfect setup, according to Vermees, tactically for them to play with Namath as a number nine. He does have some really good qualities that a number nine carries. I don't know how this team's going to look with the front three like that. He's not the prototypical number nine. He's more likely a false nine type player. The idea that the type Vermees thinks he can be is a Clint Dempsey, as of what Clint Dempsey would do in a lone striker role, type thing. That's kind of how he envisions, what Namath would do. I'm assuming that's what it's going to, with both Johnny Russell and Daniel Shalloway kind of pushing up and in, and cutting in and creating a whole lot of combinations up there. But it'll be really interesting to see how it all works. They also added, and well, I think we, on the last podcast we did, I kind of teased this move as it was a rumor. But this is, it also became official, like 30 minutes after the Namath press conference on Tuesday, that Andreu Fontes from, Celta de Vigo, was acquired for Sporting Kansas City. I'm not sure the entire thing, but they did get him on a free transfer, which is big. So all they're doing is paying his salary. I think it's a move that he's wanted, to come to MLS for a while. They've been kind of eyeing the league and felt that Sporting, he's actually really good friends and played at the Barcelona Academy, with Ilya Sanchez and, Christian Lobato, two big players for Sporting Kansas City. Lobato's just coming back from injury, and I think we'll see him a little bit more in the coming weeks. So Fontes comes in as a third center back for them. Pretty much at the moment, it seems like he's going to be backing up Ike and Beisler, just because I don't think he's healthy enough. I don't say, not that he's injured, but I don't think in terms of fitness he's there. He participated in a little bit of preseason with Celta, but this move kind of been in the works for almost a month now. He hadn't been playing any serious preseason matches for Celta, so I don't know. He was stuck in preseason mode, so I'm assuming he's not ready to contribute a 90 minutes, but he is there for bench depth purposes here, just in case someone goes down. And I'm sure they'll work on getting his fitness back up. So two moves for Sporting Kansas City. I think they needed some more depth, especially after they got rid of Emiliano Amor, who was brought in as a one-year loan deal from Vélez Sarsfield in Argentina after the Sporting Kansas City lost to Houston in Houston in the U.S. Open Cup quarterfinals. Peter Vermees called out his team and said he felt like some players quit. Report the next Wednesday was out that Emiliano Amor had departed, had his loan, was going to be leaving the club, and as part of the press release for Andrea Fontes, they announced that they had just terminated the loan and sent him back to Vélez Sarsfield. So, interesting thing there. They kind of swap out, get some depth, someone who playing style fits the system that Sporting Kansas City like. At center back, both at center back and striker, the additions of Fontes and Namath. So, a couple of needed moves for Sporting Kansas City. I haven't heard anything concrete, but I wouldn't be shocked if they're interested in bringing in someone on a free transfer, which you are allowed to still bring in people who are free agents that are not attached to any club. You are allowed to sign them through the roster compliance date. So players who are out of contract with their team, with any team currently, are still eligible to be signed in MLS. It's very rare that they get done, but Sporting Kansas City may potentially still look to add some left back depth, considering they're kind of iffy on Jimmy Madronda. I don't know what player that looks like at the moment, but you know there is still the ability for teams to add in this window, but it would have to be on players that are out of contract with their current teams.
Excellent stuff, Dan. I guess one other thing that I'll add, if the internet, that's also the transfer window relevant to the league that the player is going to. So if there is another league anywhere around the world that still has their international transfer window open, teams can now, so you said that teams can bring in players who are unattached from a club. They can also sell teams internationally. You just can't have any inner MLS moves, and you can't have anybody who's currently with another team somewhere coming into MLS. So teams can still sell players. They can still bring in guys that are open on the market. I guess the waiver window potentially is still open if anybody wanted to pick up anybody who's available on the waiver. I think Jack McInerney is out there in the ethers somewhere. But moving on, Dan, DC United brought in a new face and a familiar face in the closing hours yesterday. Bill Hamid, their longtime goalkeeper, you know, we are United, you can't hold us back, left the club at the end of the 2017 season. He was given an offer by DC United, but he chose to go to Europe after, you know, a number of years of saying that he wanted to. He went to Danish club Midtjylland. I have no idea how to pronounce this, folks. I keep looking up every time this comes up, and I'm not able to find it. So he was there with them at the start of the at the beginning of 2018, the calendar year. He's made only 3 appearances with them, and it kind of looked like he wasn't going to start going into the new European season. So he's officially come out on a 1.5-year loan. I think this is a good move for Bill Hamid, just because it's playing time and in an atmosphere where it's going to be easier for him to be judged in terms of the U.S. national team. That said, for the guy who for a number of years was considered the heir apparent to the post Nick Armando, Brad Guzan, Tim Howard generation of goalkeepers, has been really underwhelming. You know, he's been injured the last couple of years at DC United. He was kind of off and on. He didn't really fit into the U.S. national team at any point of, you know, getting to start a number of games at a Gold Cup. You know, it's been a couple of games in, you know, January, and then it's been a couple of friendlies here and there. And then ultimately he goes to Europe, something that he said that he'd wanted to do for a number of years, and we were expecting him to kill it in this same way that I guess we're talking about Zach Steffen now, and it was underwhelming and a massive disappointment, Dan. At least for me, I wonder from a U.S. national team standpoint, you know, do you consider going with Bill Hamid as opposed to the Zach Steffens of the world? But in any case, Bill Hamid's returning to MLS, maybe shoring up that defensive standpoint. I think I was reading somewhere, Dan, that DC United has just 1 clean sheet on the year, which is kind of hard for me to believe, but then also it's DC United and they had all those road games to start off the season. That said, they invested a lot of money in David Oestead, so I'm wondering financially where the team is just given their goalkeeper situation, and they also have Steve Clark, who is in a bad backup. And then they also added Vitas, left back formerly of the Portland Timbers, for $50,000 allocation. DC United, if there was one position they really needed help on, you know, the front 4 and 5 that they have with what we've seen from Wayne Rooney has been really good. You know, I'd like what I've seen from Durkin in midfield, but really that defense has kind of been a little bit of a mess. Some of that has been organization from the goalkeeper position that potentially Bill Hamid shores up in ways David Oestead has been disappointing. In 2018, their other big hole, just a gaping hole at both the left back and the right back position when you've got Nick De Leon starting because you literally have no other option at that position? What does that say about your team and how you're going about managing your personnel and your needs? So Vitas comes in, a pretty reliable left back for them. That pretty much opened up the room for the Portland Timbers to swing in Jorge Villafaña that we'll talk about. I like both of these moves. I still think there's a number of other things that have to go right, and DC really has to get on a roll with all their home games at Audi Field for them to make the playoffs. But I think this is shoring up two positions that were kind of big holes. We'll see whether or not hashtag Benny Ball can get it done. Moving on, Dan, speaking of Jorge Villafaña, two familiar faces will be returning to the Portland Timbers. Villafaña as well as Lucas Milano, who's been on a two-year loan throughout Central and South America. Your thoughts on these two moves, and how does this help the Timbers potentially compete in the Western Conference?
Yeah, I don't know how much Lucas Milano helps them. I think they were going for a familiar face as a forward, looking to try and find something that would kind of work out with the situation. Milano does that, kind of replaces Adi, someone who can actually be a backup, because I don't think Jeremy Ibovice is a valid backup option to Samuel Armenteros, who has been very good, but at the any case he gets injured, big questions start to get raised about Portland Timbers' offensive chances and their offensive ability. Because once he became installed at the top of their, kind of turned around their season, especially in the attack. Interesting move there to bring back Milano. It's just depth, another solid option to have alongside Ibovice. He never really kind of lived up to his hype when he went to Portland, and hasn't lived up to his hype when he left Portland. So I mean, it's kind of, it's insurance to have another forward on the roster. But I thought they probably could have gotten at least someone that's somewhat similar to Armenteros that was available, and which you and the player that you'll talk about next is he headed to Montreal instead. But the big move for Portland was reacquiring Jorge Villafaña. They had to go through the allocation order process to do it, and they traded, I think it was $150 or $175 in some sort of allocation money to the LA Galaxy for the top spot in said allocation order, and landed Jorge Villafaña. Brought him back, which is interesting because I believe the entire coaching staff quit from Santos Laguna.
Yes, today.
Last night. today. So, the whole Santos system, thing was a mess. It makes sense that Villafaña got out. I'm kind of happy that he got out of there if it wasn't a good situation. Gets back into MLS, gets some run, gets some consistent playing time in a league that's really improved and can help Portland push up on their playoff chances. I'm not the biggest lover of all things Portland, but I do like to see Villafaña back in MLS, and they lost a whole lot on their back line when Villafaña left them post MLS Cup trophy in 2015. There's that one. Interesting moves. I don't know how Villafaña does fill the void of Vitas and gives them a little bit more offensive impact from their left back situation, but I thought Vitas was still pretty serviceable and a good enough left back in this league that they weren't hurting at the position until they got rid of him. So I think Villafaña was kind of, okay, your situation's going south in Santos. We need a left back. Come on back, buddy. Let's do it. And they got it done. Same with Lucas Milano. As a come on back, we need another striker to round out the depth up there. The smart moves to build themselves going forward. And I believe I'm going to assume that they were working on bringing Villafaña back, which is why Vitas got moved before Villafaña came back. It's pretty clear that that's kind of they're already working on that. Good on Portland to get Villafaña back in the league. We'll see how much it helps them going forward and if they can really kind of separate themselves. Right now, with games in hand and their potential points available, they could go top of the Western Conference if they win their two games in hand on FC Dallas and everyone else in the Western Conference. So Portland has plenty of they could potentially be the first place in the Western Conference this year, which is incredible considering how bad they were when they started this year. A Villafaña signing really helps them out. We'll see how much it pushes them on. We'll really also see kind of how the shakeup of losing Adi and losing Vitas and kind of swapping in a few others for that does for the overall play and the overall kind of mental state of that team as we head on into the final stretch here, final 10, 12 games in MLS.
Moving on to the Eastern Conference and north of the border, the Montreal Impact shored up a number of different positions in the final hours of the transfer deadline day yesterday. The biggest one of those being former French international Bakary Sagna, if I'm pronouncing that correctly. He's a 35-year-old, mostly right-back defender. He's played 10 seasons in the Premier League, mostly with Arsenal and with Manchester City, but he's also bounced around other places in Europe. And the big significant thing for his resume, Dan, is he has earned 65 international caps with the French senior national team, including making appearances in the 2010 and 2014 FIFA World Cup, as well as the 2016 Euros. He was not a part of the roster for the French national team that won the World Cup just last month. But, you know, I understand that defense has kind of been an issue for Montreal this season. Their center backs are kind of getting healthy, but similar to DC, the outside back position has been a little bit questionable. I think this is a nice rental option, depending on how much they're throwing at this guy and how many years they have on him, given that he's 35 years old. They also added in a player swap, they got Quincy Amerequois, forward for the San Jose Earthquakes, for Dominic Oduro, longtime winger. Quincy Amerequois, 30 years old, Dominic Oduro, 32 now. This was a straight-up trade, though. Montreal will be eating a certain percentage of Oduro's salary for the remainder of the 2018 season. I kind of like this move for all parties involved here, Dan. You know, I think it was kind of clear that Montreal was moving on from Oduro. Quincy has only played 14 games in league play for the Quakes. Only one of those was a start. You're more familiar than I am about the dumpster fire and all the disorganization that's going on with the San Jose Earthquakes. Maybe Quincy wanted to get out of there. At the very least, I think it was kind of clear that Mikel Starry did not rate him very highly. So both players kind of getting out of a bad situation, maybe getting a nice little trial run before they head to the MLS offseason to see if they can stick in with a new team or maybe show something that makes somebody else want to pick them up. And then on the other side, I think you have two teams taking a flyer where they need a little bit of help. The Quakes, you know, don't really have a whole lot of speed on the wing from what I've seen. Maybe Oduro can help jumpstart some of their issues offensively. And then on the other side, you know, other than Manteo Mancosu, they don't really have a good underneath false nine. I think Quincy America can be that, either in a partner with Mancosu checking back to the ball from Ignacio Pianti, or at the very least helping up with some of the build-up play. So I think this is a good move for all parties involved. I don't know how much of that is actually going to work out, just given that both of them are on the wrong side of 30, and I still have some serious doubts about both of those teams making the playoffs. And the other addition the Montreal Impact made, they got Michael Azira from the Colorado Rapids, who has played in just a handful of games for Anthony Hudson this season, and they got him for a 2020 fourth round pick in the MLS Super Draft. This is effectively, I mean, the Rapids might have gotten more quality if they'd gotten like a bag of, you know, a bag of brand new MLS soccer balls or something here, Dan. You know, I guess, you know, this is adding depth at three positions that Montreal kind of needed. This is also adding three players that are 30 or older, and what's Montreal's big issue this season is that their midfield was really, really old, and their center back were really, really old. So I think these are three flyers on, can we do this to make a run in the playoffs? I don't know if this is still building for the future. I'm still not entirely sure what Saputo is doing in this. I think Remigard could get something out of this, but it's just been a really tumultuous up and down season for Montreal. If they can make the playoffs, great, but are these really three players that you can hang your hat on just given that their age going forward? I still think Montreal at some point needs to hit the reset button. They weren't able to trade or move Ignacio Pianti, so I guess he's locked in for the rest of the season. We'll see if they make the playoffs, but I have no idea. Unless this team wins MLS Cup, I don't know where this team is headed going into 2019. Moving on, Dan, Christian Ramirez, probably the biggest acquisition of, I'd say, the last 4 or 5 days in the transfer window in terms of an MLS trade to another MLS team. Christian Ramirez heading to Los Angeles FC after pretty much being on the outs with all three parties involved there in Minnesota United. He goes to a very clustered front attack that you have at LAFC. Your thoughts on this move, what it means for LAFC, and I mean, at this point, is, you know, is Minnesota United basically Adrian Heath versus Manny Lagos versus the locker room, and who wins that Minnesota fight club?
Yeah, the Minnesota situation has got to be really intriguing. It just doesn't make sense. Well, I mean, there's really no reason for someone to bring in another striker with the current striker situation that they had. They bring in a designated player that's old, that may not fit their system, and then Christian Ramirez, who is scored the first goal in history, is beloved by the fans and the locker room and the press and everyone, literally everyone, is the one who gets shipped out. It doesn't make sense. I don't know who was the one who pulled the executive decisions on all of that to do that, why he was not playing, why he was not part of their plan going forward. But depending on what Minnesota do from here on out, if they just falter, I mean, it all hell is going to break loose within that front office. If it works out, then they look really smart. For LAFC, the initial thoughts is that maybe the injury to Adama Diomande is a lot more serious than we thought. But then again, LAFC have like 7 attacking mids and like 8 different strikers that they're playing at all at the same time, it feels like. It feels like they actually have like 2 actual defenders on their roster at this point, or their back line, their back four is literally the only defenders that they have on their roster right now. So interesting move for LAFC. I don't see how he fits. He's virtually a Marco Urania who can score. So why is Marco Urania still on the team unless he goes somewhere else? There's a lot of questions that I have. I think this could bring up a point that maybe we'll make in my final thoughts, but LAFC have way too much allocation money. There's no reason that they should have been able to pull off all of these moves, because there's no reason for them to have Christian Ramirez, but they do. So whatever, we can have fun with that. I don't know how it helps them. I don't know if that is their, I don't know if that's going, if this is going to be good for them going forward. They're in a bad run of form. They've only won once in their last 5, and they're on the run. That win is at the was not that long ago. Their win was actually the furthest date away from that 5. So, 4 straight games without a win, especially in twice dropping points from a pretty sturdy winning position. So, I don't know if this was the move that LAFC needed. If their goal is to win every single game 6-3, fine. But at some point, they're going to come up against a team that can hold their offense in check, and that's not going to do well for them. So I don't get this move at all, but it happened, and that's kind of where I'm at on it. It just doesn't make sense for all parties, but it happened, which is probably the most MLS thing ever.
I completely agree, Dan. I think I'm continually baffled at how much Minnesota is trying to filter things out with bringing in attacking pieces, wingers, and forwards while their defense continues to be, Francisco Calvo and a bunch of traffic cones. I don't really understand it from that standpoint. I don't understand Adrian Heath's total, you mentioned everybody associated with Minnesota United, loved Christian Ramirez. There's one person who didn't like Christian Ramirez as the starting center forward for that team, and it was Adrian Heath, the only person who mattered in that decision-making standpoint. So I don't know what they're doing from the front office brass standpoint. This is still a team that hasn't spent a whole lot of money. I think it's poorly investing their assets, and unless they somehow make a run to the playoffs, by outscoring opponents 4-3, I don't know what you can make of the season and what you can make of Adrian Heath's future with Minnesota. Granted, there are a lot of problems associated with that club that are not his fault or his doing on the other side. I think Bob Bradley kind of has a fun problem on his hand. You mentioned the 3 forwards. They've got 3 attacking DPs that, would kind of be that front, the middle 3 in a 4-2-3-1 if they go to that formation. You've got Benny Fellharber and Lee Wynn, who are both naturally more number 10s, asked to be 8s, sometimes 10s. You've got easily 6-7 players in sort of that front attacking to middle-ish midfield to the forward striker position for, what is really 3, 4, 5 spots at the absolute most. And I don't know how you make all of these guys happy. That said, my one big criticism of LAFC this entire season has been total lack of depth. And now the one thing that they have at all of those positions now is decent depth and options for injuries, substitutions, or the busy schedule down the stretch. Speaking of clubs that are dumpster fires, Dan, the Chicago Fire at the end of the transfer window decided to waive 2 players. They waived defender Kevin Ellis and midfielder Tony Chani. Ellis has been mostly a starter for them, and Tony Chani has kind of been in and out. He's got an extensive playing time this season. And then Ellis, as you remember, Dan, got a couple of bangers that saved the Chicago Fire during the middle of the season. I think this is the perfect microcosm for what has been the Chicago Fire season in terms of being a literal dumpster fire and just having no idea what they're doing when it comes to the transfer window. Outside of Alexander Katai, I haven't really liked any of the moves that they've made. They didn't stock up in ways that they were promising in January. They weren't able to get Roman Torres, you know, as much as that was rumored right at the end of the spring deadline. They brought in almost no one in this transfer deadline, and then they cut two players who I would say, if you ask Veljko Planovic, are probably two serviceable pieces. Ellis probably one of your starters, and then Tony Chani probably your first, you know, your Dax McCarty, maybe Bastian Schweinsteiger in some ways back up in that role. So I don't understand what they're doing at this point. Now that they're out of Open Cup, you know, barring Nemanja Nikolic, you know, going, you know, warging into and stealing all of the talent from Joseph Martinez, I don't see how this team ends up making the playoffs. And given the fact that, you know, they had one really good January transfer window a couple of years ago that brought them Nemanja Nikolic, that brought them Bastian Schweinsteiger, they brought in Juninho. I want to say that was the same point that they also brought in Dax McCarty, and they kind of loaded up, and then they were absolutely on fire, and then ultimately made the playoffs. They haven't really done anything since, and Veljko Panovic is out of contract at the end of the year. I don't know. He's done a good enough coaching job with the talent that he's had to be competitive to where I'm sure he could get a job somewhere else, potentially in MLS, certainly going back to Europe, that I don't know that he sticks around, and I don't know what that means for the future of Nelson Rodriguez or, you know, the burning ashes that is Toyota Park at this point. Last big thing that we have in terms of individual rapid fire stuff, Dan, the Seattle Sounders are making a couple of moves. What do you think of them? And is this in any way going to save their season?
Yeah, so they landed Brad Smith after they've already Raul Ruiz Diaz. I thought it was really funny. They made this tweet. I'm not going to be quick enough to pull it up. But this tweet that they had, after they acquired Brad Smith, he's a fullback from
Bournemouth.
Bournemouth, AFC Bournemouth, the Southern Coastal. At one point Minnow, but pretty solidified team in the middle of the pack in the Premier League. So interesting move overall. I like what this is. I like that move just for depth there. I know Wayland Francis, they've had a lot of issues there. Tolo Nuhu hasn't been great. They have Kelvin Leerdam, who's been very, very good. But, dang it, I think they deleted that tweet because I was like going, I was looking at it and I was looking for it and it's gone. I found it. Never mind. So, this is like the most American soccer tweet ever from the Seattle Sounders. It says speed check mark, power check mark, fitness check mark, at Brad Smith 94 checks all the boxes, which is like the epitome of every American scouting report ever. Like, it, to me, I know they truly don't like disregard the technical aspect of the player, but that's just very American soccer to be like speed check, power check, fitness check. He checks all the boxes, and those are the only three boxes that we checked on the Twitter tweet. Twitter tweet, goodness, whatever. Jokes aside, I like the move for Seattle. I think the more interesting thing that happened for them was how Paulo Hurtado was nabbed away from them at the last second by a relative minnow in the Turkish Superliga because they offered more than what the Seattle Sounders could offer. Ari Lilienwall from MLSsoccer.com was reporting earlier today about the comments that Lagerway had on the whole Paulo Hurtado thing. He was in Seattle, ready to do his physical and ready to do all this stuff. He gets the offer from Turkey, flies to Turkey from Seattle, and signs with them instead. He said, this is the quote from Garth Lagerway on this, we were trying to do a really hard deal. We were trying to squeeze a DP-level player in a TAM-sized salary slot. At the end of the day, when a last-minute offer came in, where normally you could mitigate some of that, we were capped out, as in tapped out. Good play on words there from Mr. Lagerway. He says that the Sounders had $1.5 million to offer for Hurtado. Their hands were tied beyond that. And after that, there was, quote, after that, there was nothing we could do. That's what happened. I don't think there's anything to hide from there. So basically, they got, considering their cap situation and all the allocation monies, they could only do a $1.5 million. And I mean, if that Turkish team came in and did $1.5 million and won, they wouldn't have been able to do it. So they get outbid. He ends up going to Turkey. Instead, we'll see how that goes, because we've seen the way MLS players have gone to Turkey and fallen off the face of the earth thereafter. So I'm sure it's frustrating for Sounders fans, but there's also a point where your hands are tied with the salary cap and the way this league works, and that's kind of what happens. So, you know, if you're frustrated about that, don't go break down Garth Larroway's door, break down Don Garber's, because that's just a dumb roster rule thing that prevents them from getting a potentially impactful player and a player who could have made a real difference in the league in Paulo Hurtado. So Brad Smith to Seattle, left back, a good move for them. I think he'll be fine. It is supposedly a one-year loan, a full one-year loan deal with the Seattle Sounders, but there is an option that if Bournemouth want him back or need him back, they can pull him back in the January transfer window instead. So that's up for grabs for Seattle. We'll see how all that works out. But good solid left back in Brad Smith, and then Paulo Hurtado getting nabbed away in the last second. Got to be frustrating for Sounders fans on that end, but I think they've done a pretty good job to address their needs. They're doing one of their patented Brian Schmetzer Seattle Sounders late playoff runs. We'll see if it's good enough this year. It might be, because the lower end of the Western Conference is starting to get a little jammed up, and points are stalling out between all of them as they start to play each other. So right now is the time for Seattle to make some moves. We'll see if they do it.
Moving on, Dan, as we talked about, I want to say almost a month ago now, when it would have been the quarterfinals of the U.S. Open Cup, where we finally gotten, I think, something close to resolution, or at the very least, a completion of findings from the investigation regarding potential racial epithets muttered by Portland Timbers players or player towards Adama Diomande, the forward for LAFC, in their very contentious U.S. Open Cup quarterfinal match. The panel associated with U.S. Soccer, in conjunction with MLS and the two clubs involved, completed their full investigation. The U.S. Open Cup adjudication and disciplinary and discipline panel, I have not heard that actual name of that entity before, ruled that there was insufficient evidence to charge any players or issue any form of punishment towards the players or the clubs, claiming that with discussions and taking written and audio statements from all of the people involved, including the accused player, who to my knowledge has not actually been named publicly as part of the investigation, and I assume Diomande and potentially some other witnesses to it, as well as some video review. Ultimately, the panel concluded there was insufficient evidence, citing that they didn't really have any good video. This was amidst of multiple players talking in the midst of multiple words, and thus, truth is on the accused. You are innocent until proven guilty. They could not prove any guilt, so therefore they're closing it down and no action is being taken. Dan, am I missing anything? And what do you think of this ultimate result and the implications it has as far as, hashtag don't cross the line and say no to racism?
So I think that the investigation kind of served its purpose. And did what it was supposed to, and it found what it was trying. It tried to find something. But on all accounts, and from, I believe there was a separate, I won't say a separate statement issued, but it was more of a kind of an in-depth look at the process and the issues that they had in bringing about any sort of discipline on it, was the fact that they could not find one person outside of the accuser to corroborate the story. There was no video. No nothing. They said that there were multiple languages being spoken in a heated instance, and that sometimes things don't cross over well in translation, or may sound like something else that it wasn't. Move on. I think it'd move on from that, and that has to be frustrating, I think, for Diomande, because I'm not going to say he understood what was, because I don't know anything that was said, and nor does anybody outside of those who were there. Diomande, considering the amount of offense that he, I would say the amount that he felt hurt enough by it to go out and make a very public statement about what happened that night. I originally applauded. I think that the thing that from all of this that frustrates me is actually how the Timbers' statement on it today, Because, you know, I think the U.S. Open Cup and the U.S. Soccer handled it to the best of their abilities. It was on the Timbers to potentially do something if they felt necessary, even if U.S. Soccer couldn't, by their standards and bylaws and whatever. But then they decided to, they simply decided to completely, instead of go sit there and say, we're going to cooperate, we're going to do all of this stuff, we don't stand by this. If this happened, and then to do a 180 flip and come out with a statement that they did that was borderline incendiary on it, it was pretty dumbfounding, and quite frustrating. But I think a lot of people and a lot of Timbers fans as well, I think, have voiced their displeasure with it on Twitter. I'll get past the first part, which is, just some mumbo jumbo about club standards and values and core beliefs and all that crap that, you always get in a press release or a press or statement put out as start of the second part. It says, we take extremely seriously any breach of these core fundamental values by any person who represents a club. There was a thorough investigation into the alleged incident from our U.S. Open Cup game with LAFC on July 18th, which included the accounts of multiple third-party players and officials in the immediate vicinity. There is no corroboration that the incident occurred. It is our strong, that which is fine, because that's just basically reiterating what U.S. Soccer said. And then it follows up with, it is our strong belief that the alleged incident at the U.S. Open Cup match, as depicted by the opposing player, simply did not happen, which is something that U.S. Soccer would not go to that length to say. So that's kind of frustrating that the Timbers would just go out and say, you know what, because they couldn't find anything in investigation, it just didn't happen. And then they continue to say, it is regrettable that there is even a suggestion of any wrongdoing by a Timbers player, but we are pleased that ultimately due process was observed. We stand unequivocally behind our players, and we are deeply grateful for the unparalleled support of our fans. And I'm telling you that last part of that statement there is probably what is going to turn a decent amount of support from your fans, because I, knowing Portland and the way a lot of that fan base is, and that relatively forward thinking part of the country, I you would assume that they would kind of be frustrated at the fact that their club would sit there and point a finger at a guy who said I was racially abused and say you lied because we can't corroborate it. It is regrettable that there was even a suggestion. It seems very posh, and we are above this type of a thing, and very disappointing from the Timbers, very disappointing from whoever decided to pen this thing. Honestly, their statement didn't need to be three paragraphs on it. It needed to be one paragraph and say, you know what, look, this is what we stand for. We stand behind U.S. Open Cup's decision, or U.S. Soccer's decision. And we thank them for, taking into account everything, ultimately searching that due process was done in the situation, and leave it at that. But to go after then and turn and attack Diomande for making the claim, is incredibly, is mind boggling to me that they even stooped that low. So frustrating on that end from the Timbers. Don't know if there's much that you can do from it in this situation. It can't really go anywhere from here. If I'm Diomande, I'm understandably frustrated and maybe confused about how everything went down. If I am the accused player, I'm obviously relieved, regardless of whether it was said or not. But I think U.S. Soccer did the best that it could in this situation. Considering that, the video feed for that game was literally off of a Jumbotron feed. That's how U.S. Soccer's been doing these game day feeds for the Open Cup. There's nothing that you can really do on that. There's not multiple camera angles. It's literally whatever that was fed in towards the Jumbotron for the game that they were going to do. It's a bad situation in that standpoint. But it's for Diomande. But I think U.S. Soccer did what it could in the situation. And I think that this the statement from the Timbers is ultimately incredibly regrettable.
I completely agree with you, Dan. I think, you know, assuming that MLS, the U.S. Open Cup panel, and U.S. Soccer took things to the full extent that they could as far as investigating it, and presumably all parties involved from both clubs were completely compliant with the investigation, I'm totally fine with the outcome. You know, I believe that you're innocent until proven guilty. They could not find insufficient evidence. I think it is possible for us to say there is there's insufficient evidence. We're not going to charge anyone or punish anyone or name that player publicly. In hindsight, I think it was an extremely smart move to not name that player, whoever that is. I agree that he is probably extremely relieved that his name was not coming out, because I'm sure, you know, as much as people were all up in arms about this when Diamande initially posted this on Instagram, instead of just hurling that at racism or the concept or saying, hey, we need to have an investigation, Portland Timbers, look into this, it would have been hurled entirely at that player, fairly or unfairly, one way or the other. So I'm glad that that didn't happen, but I think we can have, there was insufficient evidence, you know, you were acquitted, to use the legal term, without also pointing at Diamande or anybody at LFC and saying, you were a liar, you brought this on us, how dare you, so to speak. So I'm totally fine with everything from the U.S. Soccer standpoint, for how LAFC handled it, how the U.S. Open Cup panel handled this. I agree that the several sentences in the Portland Timbers statement on this matter were certainly tone deaf, or at the very least, not really well thought out, maybe not what I'm hoping that they were intending in that. That does it for all of our rapid fire topics, Dan. It is time for us to go to weekend pick'ems. We will start on Saturday night at Dick's Sporting Goods Park at the aforementioned Wooden Spoon Derby. Colorado Rapids hosting the San Jose Earthquakes. This will be at 9 p.m. Eastern on ESPN Plus. Dan, Matt, Derby. Dan, who wins in this dumpster fire of a soccer match?
0-0 draw.
That's it? No explanation, no, or anything?
Is there any explanation needed considering the teams? You know, I actually think this one could have some room for some goals, because I like what the Rapids have done recently. Earthquakes have looked pretty good. I know they picked up 4 points in their last three games, which is the best that they've done since the start of the season. So I think the big thing for the Quakes, what I've seen from them recently, is that despite the loss to the Sounders, their 0-0 draw didn't have the final product in the final third. Same thing, they probably should have beaten Seattle like 3-1. That Rui Diaz goal came off of a mistake when they had the Sounders pinned in their own defensive third, and they broke out thanks to one bad back pass and then a bad read on the ball situation by an Earthquakes defender. That led to a 1-0 loss. Then they go 0-0 in a game where Kyle Beckerman could likely have been sent off early against RSL, which would have changed the game entirely. I would assume the Earthquakes would have gotten a goal of that. And then they go into Dallas and destroy them. They kept the same game plan, the same system, and the same style of play for three straight games, which is something that Stare has not done. And they pick up 4 points and look like they probably should have picked up somewhere between 6 and 9 points over those three games. It's a completely different Earthquakes team over the last three games. Completely different Andrew Tarbell over the last three games. Garam Kashio looks like heck of a signing for the Earthquakes back line. They've only allowed one goal in their last three games. Scored three. One goal in their last three, or two goals in their last three games, which is a record. And they did get their first clean sheet of the season in their 0-0 draw against RSL. So I'm not saying this Earthquakes team is very good. I'm not saying the Rapids team is very good. But I do like what I've seen from the Earthquakes in recent weeks. But they have to travel to the altitude. That's going to be really interesting for a team that has not, I think that they did play at RSL, and they did not look good in altitude. This team has never really looked good in altitude, except for the years where the Colorado Rapids were really, really bad, and Chris Wondolowski just like continually scored hat tricks against them. So I we'll see what happens with this Earthquakes team. I'm going to go with a draw in this game. But I do like goals in this game, so I'm going to say 2-2, just because Bakka's been on a good form. I think Kellen Acosta is going to get another goal. He's been playing really, really well. It looks revitalized in his spot within this Colorado Rapids system and lineup. And I love the diamond midfield for the Rapids right now. I don't think the Rapids have it in them to make a playoffs or to kind of make any kind of push at all, make a late push, Sounders-style push. But I think this is a much-improved team from the beginning of the season. In the last couple of weeks, they've shown a lot more than I thought that they were going to throughout this season. So they're good at home. Earthquakes have been playing good. I just think they kind of cancel each other out with their badness overall and make it a 2-2 draw.
I agree that these are two teams that are trending up. I think these are two offenses that are starting to figure each other out. I agree this is also could be a goal fest as well, Dan, just because neither of these teams have figured out how to play defense at any point this season. So we could be in for a set piece ordering this one. I'm going to say 2-1 to the Colorado Rapids, but I'll say Chris Wondolowski gets one, and this will probably be similar to the barn burner that the Rapids had, you know, without Zlatan this past Saturday. Moving on, also on Saturday night, LAFC will be hosting Sporting Kansas City. This will be at 10:30 p.m. Eastern on ESPN Plus. Dan, who you got and why?
This is going to be an interesting one because LAFC had to play at midweek. Sporting Kansas City didn't. And they do have to travel. Yes, they do have to travel cross country. But I think yesterday was probably LAFC's first day at home in like 5-6 days. Sporting Kansas City played really well. Up a man against Houston. Gianluca Busio was incredible, 16-year-old stud. He is beyond his years, both in maturity when you talk to him, both in his play on the field. He is a very, very good player and a massive prospect for the U.S. men's national team going forward. This is the American Alphonso Davies right now. This kid has a whole lot of promise. He is an incredibly creative player. His technical ability is good enough to play in MLS right now. It's just about repeating it at game speed at a high level, which in 2 years, when he's 18 years old, he could easily be doing that. So Busio is a heck of a player. I think he could end up playing in this game again. He was really impressive. But they did, he was, I will say this, that probably the only reason he made the starting lineup, at this point was because of the fact that Roger Espinoza was going to be suspended for the next game, or was suspended for that game in Houston. He will be back. I'm assuming it's going to be him, Felipe Gutierrez, and Ilya in the middle of the field. Big question for Sporting Kansas City is what they do with the striker position up top. Johan Kraze was terrible for 55 minutes. Diego Rubio is really only good as a super sub. Daniel Shalloway is, his creativity and ability is limited, when he moves central as a striker. He does play well there, but I think it doesn't suit his current, technical ability, to play as a back to goal striker, someone that they can move through. Namath is available for this, according to Peter Vermees. I think Namath ends up playing for this one in Sporting Kansas City. They're fresh. They're coming off a big, gritty win on the road. Despite being up a man, it was still pretty gritty. Houston showed well until they absolutely lost their minds in stoppage time. I don't know if Sporting Kansas City can get a win, but I think they can get a draw here. So I'm going to go with a 1-1 draw. For LAFC and Sporting Kansas City, just because of tired legs for LAFC. They did go 120 minutes yesterday, plus penalties, with a decent amount of starters in there. Sporting Kansas City are fresh. They got a lot of momentum. The squad morale right now is pretty high. You can see that in practice. Johnny Russell is probably going to be back this weekend as well. So they're getting healthy. They've added Namath. This is a good chance for Sporting Kansas City to take all 3 points. Don't know if they do it, but I'll go 1-1 draw on this one.
3 games in 8 days for LAFC, including having to play 120 minutes on Wednesday, as you just mentioned, Dan. Possibly some squad rotation, or they're at least a very, very tired and completely exhausted Lorenz Simon and a couple of other players in this game. I like Sporting Kansas City in this one. I'm going to say 2-1, and I'll throw in a little extra guarantee here, Dan. I think we're going to have two... not really a debutant goal. I guess it doesn't count as a debutant goal if Christian Namath scores for Sporting Kansas City, but I think Christian Namath scores as a starter in this one, and I think Christian Ramirez comes off the bench and then gets one to bring LAFC back into it, but it'll be 2-1 to Sporting Kansas City at full time. Moving on to Sunday, Dan, our two big nationally televised games, a huge hunt here for the Eastern Conference for both the Supporters Shield and a team trying to make the playoffs. Toronto FC hosting New York City FC up at BMO Field. No Chris Mavinga in this one because he had to go full Fight Club last weekend against Atlanta. This will be at 4 p.m. Eastern on ESPN. Dan, who you got and why?
I'm going to go with Toronto on this one. I think Toronto are very good. The biggest thing that I've seen in Toronto's play going forward, it was not the addition or the reintegration of Chris Mavinga, but it was bringing Josie Altidore back. Everybody kind of socks back in an astral position. The original game plan that was kicking everybody's rear end for 2 years with Toronto, that right there in itself brings itself back. It comes back into play when Josie gets there, because Josie can only fill the role that he's the only one who can fill that role. And I don't even know if they could have gotten a player that could come in and fill the role and do what Josie does for them. Or if they did, it would cost a heck of a lot of money. Heck of a lot of money. Josie's return for Toronto is the huge thing on this. I like NYCFC under Dom Torrent, but there's been a few. I haven't seen the NYCFC still are very young in some key places, or at least a little young in some key places, and I haven't seen enough consistency from them in those places, especially on the road. So I'm going to go Toronto FC at home. I'm going to say 2-1 just because they're hot right now. And they're really making their push, and they really can't afford to drop points anymore this season, especially with Philadelphia Union play picking up. So I'm going to go with Toronto in this one as the home team in MLS. A lot of times home teams do well. Home teams win. Toronto's a very hard place to play regardless of how good you are. So I'm going to take Toronto over NYCFC 2-1.
I agree, Dan. This is a gut check game for Toronto FC. It's pretty much, you know, it's as much of a must win without you're going to be physically, you know, mathematically eliminated if you lose this game. I think Toronto FC shows up and absolutely balls out. I love what I saw from Josie coming back from injury against Atlanta at Turf. You know, I think Giovinco's starting to get up a little bit more. Michael Bradley, I think, is starting to round into form as well. I think Toronto's in for trying to get an upset in this one. I think they'll get it. I think it'll be 2-0. Not really sure how I feel about New York City FC on the road, especially since David Villa is not really out, and they've kind of been, you know, it's been a little bit more chaos from them in the midfield. I think Toronto FC shows up. I think they are galvanized by getting a draw in Atlanta last weekend, and they're going to walk out of there with 3 points by a score of 2-0. Though I think in performance it'll probably be a little bit closer. And then our last MLS prediction of for weekend pick-ems, Dan, Seattle Sounders hosting FC Dallas. This will be at 10 p.m. Eastern on FS1. Who you got?
I'm going to go with I'm down for Dallas, because they've been weird on the road. Like, they'll come home and they'll play a crap game at home, but then they go on the road and they buckle down with their game plan and they just make things like go wrong for the home team every single time. I don't think Seattle are disciplined enough everywhere to deal with Dallas. Dallas is a team that you have to be really disciplined or really lucky to get up on, regardless of how much better you are than them, they are still a team that, or at least how much more talent you have on the roster. Because I think Seattle may have more talent on its roster, period, but their ability to come together in all phases and almost perfectly execute a game plan is not there, and that is Dallas's forte. I'm sure Oscar Pereja, well, if they can follow a game plan like they did the Sporting Kansas City, cause some mistakes, you know, kind of catch Stefan Fry in one of the games where he has a wild hair up his nose, maybe catch a back a defender sleeping, I think they could do it. I'm going to go with Dallas winning in Seattle by the score of 1-0, because that is a very Dallas thing to do.
I'm going to go with a 3-3 draw, and I'm going to say multiple red cards in this game because MLS, Dan. That does it for us as far as weekend pick-ems, but Dan, I don't think we can be a proper soccer podcast without talking about one of the best leagues in the entire world kicking off their season. The English Premier League, by the time this comes out, will be just 12 hours away from kicking off their first game, Leicester City against Manchester United, and then everybody else playing on the weekend. Dan, your general thoughts on the season we're going, and in particular, it's been a weird offseason for the Red Devils, and I don't know what Jose Mourinho is doing, and it seems like he wants to fight everyone at Old Trafford.
Yeah, as a Man United fan, I can't wait for the day when Mourinho's gone. I'm not a fan of him anymore. I think he's kind of killing us. But you know what? I think they might be good enough to finish top four. But yeah, Premier League season starting. I'm excited. Man U, I think, finished top four. I think they at least get out of the group in the Champions League. Depending on who their round of 16 opponent is, they should be able to get it done. You know, hopefully they don't crap the bed like they did last year. So, I don't know. I know Man U's didn't do much this offseason, but finished second in the Premier League last year. I don't think that they were bad enough to, I don't think that they're bad enough to not finish top four. I don't think Chelsea has improved enough to finish top four because I still have a lot of question marks about them in general. And the new manager and a whole bunch of new players and a brand new manager doesn't seem like it's going to work right away, and they're going to need it to work right away. So question, interesting thing there. Everton has a whole lot of flashy names and flashy kind of prospects that they filled in, but I don't know how all of that's going to work out because, you know, who's their coach? I just don't buy that one. So, you know, interesting, but it's Man City's title to lose. I think Liverpool or Manchester United can push them for it, but I don't think it'll be relatively close. But Premier League's on. I'll just be watching whatever American thing that there is to watch in the Premier League. That's pretty much all. That's how I've really come to like legislate my international soccer watching to be like, oh, is there an American in that game? Cool, I'll watch that one. And that's kind of how I legislate that. I'm more excited about the fact that Serie A is now a part of my ESPN
Plus subscription. Yes! Let's go, Parma!
Oh, I am going to be rude. I'm going to watch every Juventus and Napoli game that I can. Like, all see, I am so excited for that one. Inter Milan's looking interesting, too. So I'm stoked that Serie A is readily available for me. And Ronaldo is readily available for me, so that makes me happy. So lots of European soccer starting up here. I know all we do is talk about MLS on here. Trust me, we pay attention to everything. Definitely stoked for Premier League tomorrow.
I agree, Dan. I guess the big question for me is, you know, I have a lot of doubts about if anybody can really challenge Manchester City at this point in terms of competing for the league, just because, you know, by the time it was November, we knew that they were going to win. You know, I think Liverpool has made a number of really, really good ads, but how much does Jurgen Klopp favor the Champions League? I think, you, as usual, you're going to have some interesting competition for some of those last Champions League and Europa Cup spots. I think you had a number of teams overperform in terms of what their expectations are. You know, Burnley's going on their European tour, which I'm fascinated and befuddled to see in that. So I'm really curious to see what minnows can chop up. I also don't know that there's a real obvious, you know, candidate like how you had Stoke City last year where it's like, yeah, that team's getting relegated. I don't really like what I've seen from Watford in terms of the moves that they've made. But, you know, I'm excited for the season. I'm excited to see what I personally consider to be the highest quality of play in terms of international talent, competition, really, really high stakes, and just absolutely bonkers action and drama on both ends of the table. I echo your points, Dan, about Serie A finally being on ESPN Plus. That deal gets better and better for $4.99 a month, so I'll definitely be checking out a little bit more of that. And on the American side, Dan, a longtime American, English heartthrob when it comes to a club team from England for Americans. Fulham FC is back in the Premier League, and they have Tim Ream, who's expected to be one of their starting center backs. So I'll definitely be checking out everything going on with the Cottagers to see how St. Louis native Tim Ream is doing with that. That does it for all of our main stuff. Time for last words. Dan, where can people find you on the Twitter machine? Is there anything you hadn't said already?
Yeah, at Sparrowdayline4 on Twitter. I don't have much to say other than I know, again, this is not something we normally talk about on here, but American football is back. I'm a big Niners fan. I think we're going to do it this year. I'm not do it as in, oh, yeah, we're going to go to the Super Bowl. But I do think this Niners team is one to watch, and I am so excited for Jimmy Garoppolo to Pierre Garçon all season long.
Excellent stuff, listeners. You can follow me on Twitter at LWSMattPollard. Follow us across all social media platforms at LastWordSC, and check out all of our work at LastHornOnSoccer.com. Thank you to our sponsor, Roughneck Scarves, the official supplier of MLS, USL, and US Soccer scarves. Get your custom scarf for yourself, your group, or your team, or your friends, or any of your buddies at RoughneckScarves.com. I guess the last word I'm going to throw out here, Dan, I was going through, as many of you know, I do a podcast on the Rapids, Holding the High Line with Rapids Rabbi. This past Saturday was his second to last home game. This game coming up this weekend against San Jose, Dan, will be his last Rapids home game in the state of Colorado. And he had a testimonial match on Saturday morning, which was pretty fun. I'm trying to look back, and I haven't found a single Rapids testimonial match in the history of the club. So apparently, Rapids Rabbi matters more than Pablo Mascherini on some level at this point with the club right now. But I'll be helping him move out early next week, and that makes me really, really sad. So enjoy your soccer community fans. Life changes, life happens, people get married, people move, people die. Enjoy the people in your lives that you are watching, enjoying, and playing soccer with while you still have them. I will certainly be missing Mark Goodman, but the next time that he's in Pittsburgh, I will absolutely hit him up. That does it for us, folks. We'll see you next week.